Good. Well, first, thanks, Bridget, Clint, Ron, for inviting me. I'm touched to be included in this community, and so very pleased to be here. Since it's late in the course, I thought that let's try to make this as informal as possible. I will try to illustrate a series of points, but I'd welcome interruptions and questions and thoughts and criticisms. So what I want to talk about, or I think what my task is to discuss how best to exploit the continuum of structural methods that are now available, from high-resolution methods, now including electron microscopy, but especially the traditional high-resolution methods of NMR and X-ray crystallography, to electron microscopy. And in particular, this is the subject of the lecture, really, or the question that I'd like to spend time discussing with you in the next hour. And it is, as written here, what aspects of contemporary X-ray crystallography, and I really mean the way we do things in practice in contemporary structural biological X-ray crystallography, make it a particularly powerful tool. And there are three particular aspects. These are not the only ones. Three particular conceptual aspects, if you wish, as opposed to experimental ones, that I think are relevant. First, molecular replacement. In other words, that the body of pre-existing structural knowledge simplifies the determination of new structures. That has yet to be fully implemented or adequately implemented in nuclear magnetic resonance, and is my own view of why NMR is still in many ways the less productive of the two traditional high-resolution tools, because you really can't as easily, and I mean this as an oversimplification, piggyback on known structures. The second is that we can eliminate noise and impose other sorts of physical reality criteria, such as, a variety of physical reality criteria, and I'll talk about that, by density modification and improving our structural knowledge, and I'm going to give some specific examples of that because I think there's a lot of inspiration we can take from that for EM image processing. And finally, and I think most critically, as single particle analysis in electron cryomicroscopy reaches a high resolution or molecular resolution stage, as illustrated, let's say, by the rotavirus double-layered particle structure that Nico talked about, we've got to start thinking about refinement. And I do want to focus on that particularly because, in effect, once you can build a proper molecular model that touches base with biochemistry, genome sequences, and whatnot, you can then apply constraints that are basically chemical reality criteria. And all of our knowledge of chemistry suddenly comes into play. And so the ability to verify the model, to understand the model, but more than understand it, to make it right, is enhanced dramatically, because all of a sudden, for example, once you're at reasonably high resolution, all of stereochemistry is a constraint on the model building. And that's obviously not possible until you get to a stage in which you can do that. And so here's the outline of the topics I'll cover roughly. First, I'm just going to remind you about how electron microscopy or reconstructions from electron microscopy have been used traditionally to phase X-ray data. I'll give you two virus examples from our own work, but very quickly. I then want to talk again briefly about phasing electron diffraction data from coordinates derived from X-ray crystallography. Tom Valtz talked, I think, rather extensively about the aquaporin problem, so I'm just going to show you a couple of technical aspects of how some of that got done at Tom's instigation, actually. And then I want to talk about another topic that Tom will have talked about, but again from the sort of crystallographer's perspective, if you wish, and that's docking X-ray structures into an EM map in the case of the Clathrin coat. And then I'll try to summarize with some thoughts about next stages. So any X-ray crystallographic structure determination these days begins either with experimental phases, and by what we mean by that are phases from isomorphous replacement or from anomalous scattering data or some combination of them, which gives a map. And you can think of that map as very similar to the best reconstruction you will have done in single particle analysis from the sorts of image analysis that we've been talking about. Now, the experimental phases are poor. Indeed, they're quite poor in general, except for some very high-resolution situations with very strong anomalous scatterers where you can get such beautiful maps that indeed you can fit them almost by inspection. And density modification in one way or another is useful whenever possible. And that's an important thing to remember. In other words, when looking at that, let's say, at Xing's map from Nico's laboratory, what one immediately notices is that there are lots of places where you could fit stuff, but that ultimately you'd want to use those fits to improve things in order to get a clearer map. And so density modification, either solvent flattening or some sort of averaging, is useful and indeed essential in most cases. And finally, that the building rarely produces a complete or fully correct model, that you've got to refine. Indeed, all the reason that X-ray crystallography has become a reasonably high-throughput business, even with complicated structures, is that refinement is now, thanks to Axelbrunger, basically, is very rapid and very powerful. The second point, the second major way in which you get phases is from molecular replacement. That is, as I emphasized, building on existing structural knowledge. And again, since the map that you'll get phased on a model based on some existing structure is very strongly biased, and therefore, again, one or another density modification procedures, either solvent flattening or, if you're really lucky, some non-crystallographic symmetry, can be used both to eliminate or to reduce that bias and substantially to improve the phases. So again, the same sort of business. So let me start to illustrate actually what you will see are these principles in examples of taking an electron cryo microscopy, or actually originally a negative stain electron reconstruction from electron microscopy as a molecular replacement model. And so the earliest example of that is actually how we initially got low-resolution phases from tomato bushy stunt virus. And so I guess I do qualify, although you know, sort of hidden in here, electron microscopy person from way back. But basically, in order to find the first heavy atom locations, this was the bad old days when computing was both expensive and almost non-existent. In order to get initial phases to find heavy atoms in the tomato bushy stunt virus structure, what we did was take the negative stain reconstruction, the very first icosahedral reconstruction that Tony Crowther had done, and use it to phase actually not the native data, but data that were the differences between amplitudes collected from crystals in the normal mother liquor and those at very high solvent density. And those differences were like negative staining at very low resolution in the crystals. And so they were the most accurate match, although at that time we realized that the difference between that and the native data was modest. Most accurate match to a negatively stained reconstruction. And that did allow, with subsequent non-crystallographic symmetry improvement, did allow one to get phases that were good enough to find at about 16 angstroms resolution with some phase extension, and why don't I talk about that in this context, find some find the initial heavy atom derivative. So that structure was actually determined by essentially an old-fashioned or sort of a clunky version of exactly what Karin Reinisch, some 20 years later, used to determine the structure of the core of reovirus. Reoviruses are structures, or are viruses closely related, actually, to the rotavirus structure that that Nico talked to you about. They're double-strand RNA viruses and have multiple protein layers. The core is about 700 angstroms in diameter and is the active infectious, the unit of transcription inside the cell. It doesn't disassemble. It's got a polymerase inside and reels out RNA and is altogether quite an interesting molecular machine. Now, crystals of reovirus cores have this space group. It's a rather complicated cubic space group with a relatively large unit cell. But at any rate, Karin Reinisch was able to get good data to about 3.6 angstroms and obtained initial phases to 30 angstrom from an EM reconstruction that was available to us from Tim Baker. And at that time, at least, we found that the best agreement was obtained by, in a sense, doing the same thing I had done 20 years or 25 years before with the negative stain data, namely, setting the map to either 0 or 1, that is, modifying the EM density so it was effectively a mask function. But obviously, with contemporary CTF corrections and whatnot, I think that that will no longer be essential and that one will be able to get, and one can, get phases to much higher resolution that will be meaningful. Then what I want to talk about very briefly is what I mean by phase extension by averaging. This space group incorporates the tetrahedral subgroup of the icosahedral point group into the crystal lattice, so one has five-fold redundancy, non-crystallographic symmetry in the data. And so how can we use that redundancy as a way of obtaining better phases and indeed extending the phases? And this will be familiar to many of you, but I thought because it won't be familiar to all of you, I'd pause and describe the principles. The key issue is this sort of procedure works because the true asymmetric unit, the true unit of structure, is smaller than the crystallographic asymmetric unit, so that the transform is effectively oversampled by the crystal lattice. And that means that the phases, if you wish, of neighboring reflections, instead of in principle being utterly independent of each other, are actually not independent of each other because, so to speak, the Shannon sampler doesn't have a node at the neighboring reflection since it corresponds to a smaller unit in direct space and hence to a broader central maximum in reciprocal space. But even more powerful when you have non-crystallographic symmetry, in this case of fivefold, is that if you wish, consider some reflection, some integral HKL reflection. Now imagine rotating it by a fifth of a revolution in reciprocal space, and it'll come out in between a bunch of others in the middle of a little lattice cube. And that tells you that the non-crystallographic symmetry means that its phase is correlated with the phase of the reflections it winds up next to. And that's one way of thinking about the fact that you can dramatically improve the phase information by appropriate use of the non-crystallographic symmetry. Now, in practice, what you do is calculate a map, let us say, from molecular replacement, as we did, that is, or EM replacement, or whatever you want to call it, as Karin Reinisch did with the reovirus core structure. mask it appropriately.
Steve,
yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah, please do. I'm sorry. I should look at the audience, and I'm not. And so, so you, yes, thank you. Yep.
Which part of information is not modified?
I was about to get to that.
Sorry. Okay.
And in the next slide, I'll show you. So what you do is take the map, you mask it appropriately, average it, and reconstitute the average density back into the unit cell. So in this case, you take, if you wish, a fifth of the icosahedral, or of the, a fifth of the crystallographic asymmetric unit from an averaged map, and reconstitute it appropriately. Calculate structure factors and combine the calculated phases. I was about to show that in the next slide. Calculated phases with the observed amplitudes and cycle. And interestingly enough, this does converge. Indeed, it can be shown to converge even from random phases with an utterly perfect infinite resolution model, but we never have that. So that the cycle is basically this. You've got a map from what it, the current map, you modify it appropriately, calculate a transform to get calculated phases and amplitudes, but then combine those calculated phases. And you can do this in various weighted ways, and you can weight them back with the original experimental phases if you're worried about the thing diverging too rapidly or whatever.
Is that convergence?
No, not at all. Indeed, it works best, or it works fine. The only limitation at quite low resolution, I mean, we did it at 16 angstroms, and that is, Sayre's equation applies for another reason, it's 30 angstroms, and because the square of a step function is also equal to itself, which is the assumption of Sayre's equation, but you don't use it. So this doesn't. Gerard Braconia showed that this density modification procedure is fully equivalent to the rigorous sort of Shannon calculation in reciprocal space. But the reason to go this way is that this is a calculation that goes as n. These go as n log n, but this goes as n squared, where n is the number of reflections or the number of points in the map or what have you. And so that this calculation is horrendous and still pretty much undoable. This one is actually utterly doable, and we now do it routinely. It's not been reanalyzed recently theoretically, but certainly we know from just long experience that amplitudes of conventional good X-ray crystallographic accuracy, let us say an intensity R factor of 10%. I mean, that's actually not great, but let's say a conventional intensity R factor of 10%. And an averaging of at least 3 works pretty well. So that fluhemagglutinin, for example, just from my own observational experience, fluhemagglutinin that Ian Wilson did when he was postdoc with Don Wiley, I don't remember what the intensities were, but they were collected in pre-synchrotron days, and I'm sure that the R factor was worse than 10%, and had only threefold averaging, went from an initial heavy atom map that looked like a Jackson Pollock painting to a structure that could be fit at about 3 angstroms resolution. So the limitations there were the inaccuracy of the data, whatever it was, and the fact that there was a resolution cutoff. The way to see the effect of the resolution cutoff, this is a quick aside for Powell, since he'll, is that the formulation of the problem in this space is basically that there is a that you can describe this part of the calculation as a matrix H times the current vector of Fs, that is, as complex numbers, yields the next round in which, and then you can go back and re-normalize the Fs and cycle. And that matrix
is populated, if you do things right, largely near the diagonal. And so then if you think about a resolution cutoff, it means that terms near the outside are missing things on the other side of the diagonal where you've had the square cutoff. But that's a sort of Powell aside.
So the amount of space that you can flatten makes a big difference. So even Evolutionary,
wasn't it about 75% solved? Correct. That did help a lot. So that if you don't have non-crystallographic symmetry, you can still gain from flattening the solvent. And if you have very high solvent fraction, we're going to get to this a little later in an EM case, if you have very high solvent content in the unit cell, then that is relatively powerful. A way of thinking about the power of the redundancy you've got is that, let us call the volume of the crystallographic asymmetric, Michael Rossmann thought this through, the volume of the crystallographic asymmetric unit, let us call V, and let's call the volume of 1/n of the non-solvent part, in other words, the protein part, and then n is the non-crystallographic symmetry, the volume of 1/n of that being the, I'll call U, so that in the case of the reovirus cores, the solvent content was probably, it was not so wonderful, it was probably about 60%, and so that there's 40% protein, and then we had a fifth of that, so that the volume U is 8%. So if you wish, the power is, or goes as V over U, in other words, is about 12, so to speak, 1 over 0.08 or whatever. Anyhow, so that if you just have solvent flattening and don't have that nice division by N, even if N is only 2 or 3, then solvent flattening is not desperately powerful, but useful nonetheless, and we use it all the time and quite routinely. And once you've got some non-crystallographic averaging, or averaging between two different samplings that are obtained by two different crystal lattices, then you're in good shape, if you can make the assumption that the structure is the same in the two non-isomorphous crystals, and you can often do that. So that's what allowed one to extend the phases. Basically, because, as I emphasized, the phase of a neighboring reflection is not independent of the phases in the shell just inside of it, there is, if you proceed very gingerly, a phase extension power in this that means that if you're lucky, you can slowly phase extend outward. And indeed, Karin found that with the reovirus core, she could extend from those 30 angstrom EM phases all the way out to 3.6 angstroms with judicious remasking at various stages. As Richard correctly reminded me, the solvent mask, is critical in the process, and you want to make the mask as fussy as you dare without cutting stuff off, because, again, as a Powell and others aside, that H-matrix, as Tony Crowther called it, becomes increasingly off-diagonal as the mask has high-resolution terms. If you wish, the Shannon sampler gets more and more powerful. And so you're better off redetermining the mask as the mask at various stages as the map gets better and better. But at any rate, that procedure with some judicious tweaking enabled us simply to get a map and ultimately to build an atomic model and refine it. So I can pause there since I'm going to go on to sort of topic two. And that's a sort of inverse example of molecular replacement, namely going from, and you've heard about this, so I'm going to be rather quick, going from X-ray coordinates in this case, or coordinates based on X-ray crystallography, to the determination of a structure by electron diffraction. And it proceeded basically exactly analogously and to the way you do molecular replacement in X-ray crystallography. Indeed, once one had HKL and Fs, the problem looked essentially identical to any X-ray structure determination and used standard X-ray methods as these as this list will show you. Just a one point from the data table is this. Let me go back. One of the things you've got to do, of course, is to refine the unit cell, because if you wish, that's going to depend on EM parameters that are not nearly as perfectly determined as the X-ray wavelength, which is really what determines the unit cell in X-ray crystallography. The unit cell is determined in X-ray crystallography by the curvature of the Ewald sphere and the angle at which a reflection passes through it, because you can determine the space group axes. And so that it's relatively independent once you've got things indexed right. Indeed, it's totally independent once you've got things indexed right of physical parameters like the crystal to detector distance. It's dependent only on your knowledge of the wavelength, which you can calibrate extremely accurately at synchrotrons, and hence the curvature of the Ewald sphere. So that the unit cell is an experimental parameter in X-ray crystallography, but less so here, at least in practice, and so you've got to do some sort of grid search to get that right. But otherwise, yeah. Oh, in this case, just try a bunch of, in other words, the estimate from the standard EM camera length parameters was, I think, 68 angstroms. The answer turns out to be 65 and a half. I think they did a one angstrom or half angstrom trials, plus or minus five angstroms from the initial approximation to figure out which one gave the best, Tom will probably remember better than I, gave the best agreement in the molecular replacement parameters. And then again, there was a sort of finer grid recheck of that during the refinement procedure, at least in the early stages. Pretty obvious sort of thing. I mean, nothing fancy. I mean, obviously, if one wanted to write EM, not EM specific necessarily, but EM friendly, software to do some of this, then you'd somehow incorporate this either as a refinable parameter or as a standard loop in the program, but it's easy enough to do it by hand. And likewise, then refinement proceeded with standard simulated annealing procedures. This will look utterly familiar to X-ray crystallographers. Solvent flipping simply means that you can accelerate the solvent flattening power in the sort of cycles I suggested as, who was it, Andrew Leslie first or Abraham, pointed out in doing the F1 ATPase structure, as I recall, by literally not just flattening the solvent, but turning positive noise peaks into negative noise. But it accelerates convergence in practice in this procedure. At any rate, the one point I wanted to make is that obviously what you do is interpolate along the lattice lines from non-integral sampling onto some lattice, some C star axis, if you wish, to give you the L index that depends on the presumed thickness of the object and obviously how many tilts you've got. And so if you have lots of extra data, many more tilts than you might need minimally for the known thickness, then you could in principle make the unit cell very large, i.e. the sampling very narrow. And to the extent you can collect data so that sampling is meaningfully narrow, and that's an experimental question that I'm less expert on than various people in the room, then you could use increasingly powerful solvent flattening tricks with a 2D crystal to accelerate the refinement, or for that matter, in principle, even to extend phases. We've tried some, with Tom, some rough calculations along those lines, but at the moment they'll need more careful attention to do it right. Okay, I think that I can pause there again, because I'm now going to go on to just a couple of points about docking models into cryo-EM density. Well,
see, I'm curious, in the refinement process,
yeah.
Do you use the standard crystallographic software to do it?
Yep, totally. That is this thing called CNS, which is crystallography and NMR something.
System.
Mark Potashny made me allergic to the use of the word system. He said that Al Hershey had told him that Ptolemy had a system and that you shouldn't use it in biology, but it turns out we do all the time.
Do you feel the same way about simulation instead?
I don't know. Design.
Please.
At any rate. Over drinks tonight? Actually, no, systems biology, that is, if you really want, the intellectual history of modern biology is that there's an informational tradition, genetics, if you wish, and a structural tradition, that's us. And they meet at various points, like the DNA structure, that are incredibly critical for productivity in the next stage. So likewise, the latest incarnation of the informational tradition is systems biology, and we're the latest or the modern incarnation of the structural path, and likewise live cell imaging and all that. And they're going to crisscross from time to time, and let's hope that they continue to crisscross, and that will indeed drive biology forward in the next 30 to 50 years, just as it did since 1953. So. Yeah.
In the EM field, people always like to talk about signal to noise ratio.
Mm-hmm.
And in the X-ray, we always talk to our factor of everything. And this too, because in my instinct, I would say in the X-ray, our signal to noise ratio would be very high. But we have millions of molecules aligned in an accurate position to
actually. Correct. Yeah, I don't know quite how statistically. Powell, have you thought about that? Is how best statistically to think about those things? In other words, how to translate signal-to-noise, standard signal processing ways of talking about signal-to-noise into, in other words, you're quite right that what, and I'm about to get to it, that the advantage of any crystallographic procedure is that all of the molecules are held still for you, and what you are measuring is literally the Fourier amplitude of the averaged structure. In other words, the Bragg condition or the conditions for positive reinforcement or for interference, coherence. Thank you. Are such that. You're guaranteed, if you wish, to be taking the transform, measuring the transform of the appropriately averaged structure. Whereas in the single particle situation, for example, then there's heterogeneity that is not so averaged automatically and is, of course, the source of some of the problems.
But that heterogeneity has been raised as leading to gross overestimate of the precision and accuracy of X-ray coordinates. There's a paper by Tom Lindell.
Well, no, that's a separate issue, and that may be correct. That is, because we are in refinement, it is because the number of observations, the number of measured reflections, is not substantially larger, even with quite high resolution, than the number of parameters. The refinement needs to be heavily constrained, and conventionally we constrain it by standard stereochemistry. Now that's fine, provided that there is one model that appropriately fits the data. But what I've just said and what you point out is actually the data are really the Fourier transform of an averaged model, and that averaged model, even if you were to fit it with point atoms as a decent approximation, because each one has a B and hence a spread, that average model doesn't necessarily, that best average model, doesn't necessarily have to have correct stereochemistry, as would be the case, for example, if you've got two equal representations of a sidechain rotamer and whatnot. In practice, that has not dramatically screwed us up, because after all, X-ray crystallography has given mechanistically useful, drug design useful, et cetera, coordinates. But you're quite right. At the level of trying to ask, do we have the most correct fit, blah, 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 you're quite right. Yeah, in other words, in X-ray structures, the fall-off is determined by, if you wish, how identical. This is what we call the temperature factor. It has nothing to do with thermal vibration. In practice, it has to do with just the sorts of non-identity from unit cell to unit cell that we were just talking about. But one's found that is adequately approximated by, in the high resolution fit or reasonably high resolution fit, by Gaussian or, if necessary, anisotropic quadratic parameters for each atom or each group of atoms. And so one's found, at least in practice, a sensible way of correcting that, and it isn't usually so severe. But you're quite right. It's a problem to be thought in detail about in the electron microscopy case. Why?
So how incomplete the data was that this program was, because...
You're talking about...
In the refinement of aquaporin, because...
In the aquaporin refinement.
Right, because we heal only up to 70 degrees or so, some missing information.
It's there. Yeah, 80% overall and 70% to the 2 angstrom or 1.9 angstrom limit. So pretty good.
So anything lower than that may not work.
Well, if you had 80% sampling but it were random, then that would probably be fine. Again, the way to think about it is just once you've got stereochemistry to constrain you, then X, Y, and Z are linked to each other. In other words, if a given chemical bond is parallel to the Z-axis, and so Z is the only parameter that you really care about there, then the next chemical bond is off at a tetrahedral angle, and all of a sudden that Z correlates with this X and Y, et cetera, et cetera. So that you get a lot of three-dimensional mixing once chemistry comes to your rescue. One of the things that is not so often, is often done, but not as powerfully in X-ray crystallography, is to use not atoms as the elements, but let us say alpha helices or other chunks of the structure. And we do that. In other words, rigid body refinement of that kind is nicely built into that CNS program, it hasn't been made desperately powerful by, say, simulated annealing minimizers. It still uses relatively old-fashioned optimizers, at least in CNS, and so that it has a relatively modest radius of convergence compared with what we can do once we've got atoms. But that's just because of the programs. In principle, you could think of ways of doing a constrained rigid body fit to make sure the joints were still stereochemically respectable. But the software at the moment, actually in the most powerful form, doesn't happen to exist. James.
Under a specific image condition using standard.
Let me turn that over to Powell or to Tom or to someone who's done this experimentally. It always helps to know the answer in advance, doesn't it? Let's talk briefly. Oh, sorry, Tom.
Just a question. I don't know if it's at all related, but if you do molecular placement, you have a model bias, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's also model biases in body electron microscopy. Is there anything we can learn from molecular placement X-ray crystallography that we could use?
To avoid or to get around. I'm trying to see whether, in fact, I'm going to address that. I'll tell you what. Ask it again in about 5 minutes. I think I've got some stuff about it in the next bit. But at any rate, the key way of getting around model bias in X-ray crystallography is to use one or another density modification trick. So that a question is, how could one build a comparable sort of cycle in? Let's talk about it at the end of the talk, because I'm going to just talk a little bit about thoughts on refinement, which is already looking forward. And it's really the same sort of thing. How do we bring useful other a priori data back into the process, in a certain sense, to keep ourselves honest? There's what I guess I'm emphasizing over and over again, and it really might be the one-line conclusion of the whole talk, is that the reason X-ray crystallography has become so powerful now that all these methods are developed and whatnot is that one is able to touch base with all of chemistry. Bond angles, bond lengths, you name it. All of the body of already determined structures. And that was not possible early on, either when there were very few structures or when one was trying to struggle with low-resolution maps, because there was a time when you took so long to determine a structure, you published a 6-angstrom map and then went on. And at that stage, there were no good criteria for whether you were right or not, and it had to be common sense, as it is now. But one would very much like much more rigorous validation procedures, and let's come back to it, depending on what I say or don't say in the next bit. So you saw, I think, the transferrin receptor story from Tom in his talk, but I simply wanted to use this as an icon to answer a question that I think was in that list of questions that Ron Milligan handed out yesterday. And it had to do with, once you've got things docked, what kinds of refinement and whatnot do you are you comfortable with? And so I think that, in a way, there are two key resolution barriers, and they correspond simply to hierarchies of protein structure. We're talking about proteins. If there were nucleic acids, this would have to be a little bit modified. One is around a bit beyond 10 angstroms, which are the packing of alpha helices or the packing of two sheets against each other. And the other is at about 4 angstroms when you can finally begin, 3.8 angstroms if you wish, is the alpha carbon to alpha carbon distance, when you can finally begin to see bumps for large side chains or the grooves of an alpha helix. I mean, these are, of course, approximate. But so that I would argue that the reason this was quite powerful is that that one had good structures that could be docked, and the rod-like densities, they're not so evident from this particular illustration, the rod-like densities for the various alpha helices meant that you could position the elements quite accurately and could notice that two lobes of the transferrin molecule were displaced from each other with respect to the way they are in the unbound transferrin and so on. But I think that I'd still be rather uncomfortable, maybe if you had 5-angstrom data, but not yet 4, rather uncomfortable getting too cavalier about moving helices around and so on. There are a couple of them that are clear, but getting too cavalier about normal modes and Lord knows what still makes me worried. But that's my personal answer to that question. Once we get to 4 angstroms and we've got real chemistry at our disposal, I'm much more comfortable. Any rate, so I guess here are a couple of questions that I think I'd just like to emphasize from what I've said that are worth working on. Can we use a molecular model as an initial reference for single particle lamina, a proper molecular model? Could one have used transferrin receptor, which is essentially unaltered in that? That is, transferrin receptor here is more or less straight from the crystal structure. Could you have used transferrin as some sort of partial molecular model, and how might you think about that? This is worth thinking about because there are going to be lots of cases where a serious amount of the structure is already known and known quite accurately, one way or another, either from other EM structures or from X-ray crystallography. Incidentally, in molecular replacement calculations with X-ray crystallographic amplitudes, and the situation will be different in electron microscopy, quite a bit different probably, then when you've got a model that represents more than 50 or 60% of the data, of the structure reasonably well, and reasonably well is rather critical, then you can often get a bite, so to speak, on the molecular replacement problem, get an initial fit that turns out to be right. And in those of you who might be thinking about that, I think this is an important issue. In X-ray crystallography, certainly, we tend to eliminate the very low spatial frequencies because they're not well fit by any structure factor calculation based on a molecular model. They're solvent terms and all that are convenient to forget rather than having to deal with. And so one wants to think about the extent to which that's useful in the EM case. And then a second question, I showed you that Tom Waltz's group had proved that you can beautifully exploit molecular replacement in 2D crystallography, and I think that working on how to do better and better phase extension, all these things, is an important question, including, and I'd like to make a plug, I think, including some since the aquaporin structure shows how beautifully you can do and how rapidly you can progress when you've got good 2D crystals. My impression is that the number of person years, if you wish, dedicated to learning how to get good 2D crystals is some tiny, tiny fraction of the number of many person team years practically dedicated to how we have learned to get good 3D crystals. So that I think one shouldn't lose faith in 2D crystallography because in a certain sense it impresses me that it's limited as much by the number of people just by trial and error accidentally discovering little tricks to make better 2D crystals, such as the knowledge that lipids matter, for example, in the aquaporin structure that you will have learned from Tom's talk. So, but I'm a sort of cheerleader, I think, for trying to, yeah. Lost in the electron beam. No, I mean we gathered data to the 110 order with non-synchrotron sources with Bushy stunt virus crystals, and that was 1/110 was a spotty centered cubic space group. 110 was 1/280 angstroms roughly, and I don't remember what we did with real. If you care, you can get all the way down to the beam stop if you want. Small-angle X-ray scattering measurements done on, obviously, specially collimated beams. But those are reflections are so strong that it's trivial to measure down. Now, you're right. You go to the average synchrotron beamline, and they've got a beam stop as large as a barn door, and they won't change it for you. Yes, of course. But that's luddite behavior of the beamlines, not a serious problem. Problem in principle. Okay, let's go on to talk about density modification in the context of the Clathrin coat structure that, again, I think you
Tom, you did talk about this, didn't you, in your talk some? Or oh, okay. It was in one of the handouts, was it? Or oh, just okay. Any rate, just to remind you that Clathrin coats form around membranes, vesiculate membranes, by an assembly process that involves adapter proteins that link the clathrin to membrane-anchored structures and ultimately self-assemble into closed structures that then quickly disassemble, etc. The lattice-like characteristic of those clathrin coats derives from the fact that clathrin itself is a trimer with this grotesque spider-like shape with a single long heavy chain, polypeptide chain, extending from the tip of the spider leg all the way in to the center. There happens to be a light chain associated with it, but we won't worry about that. And the overall contour length of this thing is about 450 angstroms. It fits into a lattice like this with one hub associated with each lattice point, and so you've got a highly imbricated structure. Now, by these coats can be reassembled into, whoops, it's all right. Now, this was, I think, a movie of some kind, but oh there we go. Well, it doesn't make any difference. Can be reassembled in vitro, clathrin, with some of those adapter proteins which form a mess inside. It's just sort of a little microprecipitate. This is non-stoichiometric and disordered. If you do the assembly right, you get a very large proportion of a single design, which is this so-called D6 barrel. It has D6 symmetry and is a barrel-like structure with one clathrin associated with each vertex. And so that, as you'll have heard, I think, Alex Foten, working closely with Yifan Cheng and Tom and Nico, was able to get this reconstruction, which has a nominal resolution of about 11 angstroms, I think, or somewhere in there. I'll explain how we got to higher resolution in just a minute. And that involved, among other things, a procedure so that the reference image was soft masked to get rid of all this, since each projection will contain some unique version of this stuff projected, and that will clearly mess up or potentially mess up the alignment procedure just because of the individual features of any given projection that will be due to the particular adventitious distribution of the stuff inside. As I said, the imbrication of the clathrin trimers can be diagrammed like this, and what I'm showing here is that there are, in fact, in the asymmetric unit of this D6 point group, there are actually three trimers. They're color-coded here, red, green, and yellow. And so there are 9 non-coat symmetry-related versions of any bit of chemistry here, so to speak. Now, in fact, part of the secret of all this is that these legs are somewhat compliant and they bend at the knee and so on, so that you... if you'd like to compare, let's say, the proximal leg of the red guy and the proximal leg of the green guy, you can, or the yellow guy, they're right opposite each other, you can derive a local transformation between them, but that will not necessarily, indeed it doesn't, relate the distal leg of the red guy to the distal leg of the green guy. You need to modify that transformation. But at any rate, provided you can do that, and you can, then you can average 9-fold any bit of density. And when you do that, then you get a map that I'll show you in a moment. You may have seen that you can actually fit with elements of the X-ray structure or elements of the molecule for which X-ray structures are available, namely this segment from Francis Brodsky and Bob Flederick, this segment from work we had done. And so here is an example of fitting that
straight segment to the electron density map in a top view and a side view after this sort of segmental ninefold averaging. And what we've got here is basically just a map cut off at the same spatial frequency with an appropriate fall-off adjustment, best to match the scaling in reciprocal space. And you can see this is cut off at 8 angstroms, or 7.9. And you can see that that's at least a fair estimate of the spatial frequencies present, if you wish, at least visually, in this map. Obviously, it's a little awkward to use conventional resolution criterion because of this averaging, this extra, we called it non-coat symmetry averaging, and that abbreviates as NCS, which is what people use for non-crystallographic symmetry, so it's convenient. But at any rate, what we haven't done yet, however, and I think it's going to be interesting to do, I'll come back to this in a minute, is then to see whether that improved model can be used in some way to further to improve orientation parameters or other things. In any case, given that map, one was able, because we knew that this region actually was represented a repeating structure, to make homology models of the entire structure and basically fit essentially the entire map, including finding that there's a long alpha helix that wasn't part of the repeating structure that makes this tripod-like structure in the middle and indeed corresponds to a sequence here near the C-terminus that is sensibly a long helix from the absence of prolines and glycines and so on. And so a couple of questions that aren't answered by things we've done yet, but I think are worth asking and need to be asked in the context of higher resolution structures like the one Nico talked about as well. Can we improve a reconstruction by use of a model built into the density as some kind of new reference? It's another version of that molecular replacement question I asked. And then how do we treat the model? How do we treat the envelope function? All those, in other words, food for thought. And can we refine a model against the observed data, the projected images? Because as I emphasized, it's the refinement cycles that have made X-ray crystallography so powerful and so broadly useful and so verifiable. And so let me talk just in the last few minutes to stimulate discussion, because really this is kind of an au revoir part of the talk, about this question. So in X-ray crystallography, as I said, we measure amplitudes that are by experimental arrangement coming from an average structure. Single particle EM, what we've got are measured projections that contain unique noise, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, that is, some of it is real noise, but some of it, as I said, isn't noise in the literal sense. It's just the unique projection of stuff we don't care about, like the disordered adapters inside the Clathrin coat, that will disturb our estimate of the projection parameters. And so just to remind you that in crystallography, the observations are then amplitudes, and we refine the model parameters against these observations using chemistry as a constraint. And so if the model's incomplete, we use the refinement to improve the phases and get a better map and extend the model using the cycle that I suggested. The refinement minimizes something like this. There are various modified targets and whatnot. But basically, the refinement minimizes the disagreement between the calculated and observed amplitudes appropriately normalized. Now, in EM, if the observations are the projections, what parameters should be refined? And so here's my question, and I think the answer is probably at the moment no, but when will we have enough might be how, the way I should have phased this, to refine some sort of agreement factor like this, which would be the calculated projection for the ith projection, and there are lots of them, there are thousands and thousands of these, of course, as a function of U and V, the projected parameters. But, you know, as an implicit function, if you wish, of the model parameters, the coordinates and Bs or whatever you want for the model orientations and positions of an alpha helix, if you want to parameterize it on substructures, and the Euler angles and or phase origin of that particular projection. In a way, can one figure out a way of doing this, let's say, where each cycle or series of cycles you update, instead of trying to refine these parameters strictly, you know, writing down d theta, can you just update this every cycle with the previous round of projection parameters and so on? And so that's a question I think that's worth people in this group thinking about, because as all of these results and you know, Nico's result and so on show, one's ready to think about this, which one wasn't even 3 years ago.
Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent suggestion. But just for future thinking, maybe we want to define a different parameter. The problem with the R factors that it's not differentiable.
I understand that.
So it's an historical artifact.
Sure. No, and I was just trying to write down something that's exactly analogous to this.
Right.
What I added here over, this is a sum over H and of I. What I was doing here but didn't, was to think about a case where actually there is another parameter, a theta. Let's suppose we had a whole bunch of non-isomorphous data sets, but where we could assume that the structure was the same, was the same coordinates, but packed in different unit cells or even just slightly non-isomorphous unit cells. We don't at the moment have a generalization in the existing crystallographic program to do the refinement against a group of data sets, so non-isomorphous data sets, if we could make the additional powerful assumption that the structure is identical in them. We've done that, but just by a kludge, constantly averaging every cycle. It was a pain in the butt. And so that would, since it would then be molecular replacement parameters that you'd need to update or whatnot, that would be exactly the same problem as here. And so that might be a way of trying it. Powell?
Yes. So, if I can comment on it. So, in fact, we're doing something very similar with Christian's part from
Berlin.
Cool. With the ribosome, we have more or less agreement with Christian's part for actual problems. Not two problems, really. The first one is the overfitting, which is, unless you have a very good estimate of the error, you can get the agreement to two angstroms, but it's needed.
Right. So obviously the second point is both an issue of technical correspondence, but also potentially an issue of the nature of the ribosome, and will vary from example to example. But obviously we'll need to pay attention to that, and how are you going to need to build other refinement parameters in, and so on. Overfitting problem, which was always, of course, a severe problem in X-ray crystallography, the way one's gotten around that in most cases, that is, or to get an honest estimate of whether you're starting to overfit, is to use a cross-validation trick, the so-called free R factor that I'm sure you know about. And as you probably also know, in recent maximum likelihood implementations of the target function in simulated annealing refinement, even the probability parameters in the maximum likelihood implementation are derived from the cross-validation analysis in order to build that build the statistics in correctly. So if you look at what, if you wanted to see whether there's anything to inspire you in that, then look at what Randy Reed and Axel Brunger have done in that context. But obviously, the details of the situation are different because the nature of the experimental data is pretty different. James? No, I was saying, I think that the, in Fred's talk, he was talking about just updating, the, you know, this said theta old or something in some subsequent cycle. So you could just think about updating this every cycle or something like that. But I'm this is about a day old in my head, so that, sure, there may be some very clever tricks. I'm not a good applied mathematician by any means, so that there may be very clever ways of thinking about this problem that with contemporary techniques of optimization that go way beyond anything I even know exists. So.
This may actually be more of a question for Powell, but since in the ribosome there's no internal ruler, it's not a periodic object, imagine that you had a 1% difference in scale between your X-ray structures and your EM structures. Could that account for some of the discrepancies?
Yeah, I think linear scale is going to be a key issue for the reasons I said, that we have the lucky situation in a crystallographic measurement of having the curvature of the Ewald sphere, which is, you know, dependent only on the calibration of the synchrotron, which you do with a, you know, a standard crystal that's known to six significant figures or something horrible. And my guess is there will be many cases where the latter is true, and there'll be also plenty of cases where the former is true, and it'll depend on the model, on the molecule, just as, and the same is of course true in X-ray crystallography. Can we get crystals that diffract better and so on? And then that depends on the molecule as much as anything else. Although, actually, my conviction is that we can do a lot better experimentally. That is, what we're limited by in many cases is the fall off of a. Let's suppose we can't get the crystal any better, so we've got a given fall off that we're stuck with. And then we hit the wall of the so-called water ring or solvent ring at about 3.9 angstroms, which limits resolution in many, many cases of considerable interest. And if we now have tiny synchrotron beams that are perfectly collimated, if we had a detector that matched, that had a pixel size of, let's say, 5 microns, and we could go to long distance so the beam wasn't diverging but the water ring was falling off as 1 over r squared, we might actually be able to push ourselves out by a little bit. And I'm confident that is, it's not as if there's a cliff, it's a fall off that's crudely Gaussian, and or maybe it's a little faster than that, but it's the same sort of story. There is signal there. I always tell people in my group, if they say, oh, this diffracted to 5 angstroms at home and 3 angstroms at the synchrotron, I said, no, it was diffracting to 5 angstroms at home. You just couldn't see it. Or to 3 angstroms at home, you just couldn't see it. But we've deluded ourselves into thinking that because you can't record the diffraction, or you can't see it above the noise, that the diffraction isn't there to be extracted one way or another. And I think that's exactly the point you're making, I think. Any rate, it's just about the end of my time. So I'll just say that Karen Reinisch, who's now at Yale, did the reovirus structure I was talking about. As an example, Tamir Gonin, who worked with Tom Valtz and Yifan Cheng, were responsible for the aquaporin work and the transferrin receptor work. From my group, Peter Slees helped with both of those. Alex Fotin was a graduate student who really worked jointly with me and Tom and Nico and Tom Kirschhausen to get the clathrin structure done. And there's a poster, I guess it's this evening, from Yijing on our current next stage of that project. And then finally, the only reason I'm even able to stand up here with any validity at all is that basically I've had the privilege of working with Tom and Nico and David, and it was David's wisdom to get us all connected early on when Tom and Nico arrived in Boston that started all that. So I'm really just a spokesperson for this little axis. Thanks very much.
Yes, Steve. You've done some modeling now. You've taken X-ray structures and put them in, and sort of one of the questions I had is what do you do about the interaction between the component proteins when you get down to packing side chains and so on? Is that just beyond the capability, or do you see you put sort of a mushy side chain in and then just dock them as best you can, or do you remodel them, or is it believable?
That's at the moment, not much wisdom, because when we've done that sort of thing, it tends to be very much a seat of the pants business for us. That is, I think the next is Klaus Schulten the next talk? He's probably the real expert on thinking about this sort of thing. Is he the next one up after the break? So why don't we set that as a challenge for Klaus to address? I mean, he and his school, if you wish, have made critical contributions in this sort of area. What we've done has been entirely seat of the pants. I mean, it's been literally my eyeball most of the time looking at stuff rather than trying to address things in a systematic way, and have been done by hand using a fitting program like O rather than by computational rationalization methods. But I precisely because I haven't felt that any of the ones freely available to non-experts have been ones I was comfortable with. But I think we need to think about that and figure out how to do that right. That's why I said for the moment I'm uncomfortable with thinking about making the transferrin model, let's say, any softer than two rigid bodies, although in principle there's probably enough information there to make it a little softer than that. But I'm not comfortable that any of the ways currently used aren't overfitting. But that's a personal guess, not a statistically accurate estimate.
I wonder whether you calculate the asymmetric B factor in aquaporin zero case. And in our experiences, sometimes characteristically different from parallel to membrane surface and perpendicular to membrane surface because of many asymmetric feature of two-dimensional crystalline specimen preparation techniques. And then, in case of aquaporin zero, it's a beautiful crystal, and then should have less difference. But then, generally, we have a severe problem. So have you any idea?
I'm actually going to look back at the table to see. Tom will probably remember. Is there an anisotropic B? There seems, let's see, a crystallographic refinement. I don't remember. Tom, do you remember? I think it was isotropic. But you're quite right. That is, I think we do have there enough data that we could look at that. I think that I'm sure it was looked at because, in a sense, it's almost instinct for anybody using these crystallographic, X-ray crystallographic refinement programs to look at that. It obviously wasn't so anisotropic that it seemed worthwhile. But once you get to 1.9 angstroms, you can do a lot. And so I think as Tom's laboratory in particular continues with this, they'll probably have a closer look with when other lipids are there and whatnot. It's a very good point. And it's sort of a routine consideration in any X-ray refinement.